contrary to popular wishes, I'm not bringing back Paul Hudson's way of starting the podcast. If anybody really wants me to do that, I will, though. Does anybody miss that?
No. Although we saw Paul yesterday down in the pub. That was quite
good.
We
did, actually.
Yeah.
So if anybody's wondering how Paul's doing,
he seems to be doing fine.
Yeah. So this is Season 3, Episode 13 of the Tux Radar podcast. I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm the friend Hernandez. I'm here today.
Yay, Effie's here.
Effie.
I couldn't be bothered turning up.
How's your house? Is it all right?
Yeah, I'm not cleaning the sewage today, so that's right.
Okay.
Shall I go next?
Yes, please. Yeah.
I'm Graham Morrison.
I'm Jonathan Roberts.
I'm still Andrew James Gregory, M.A.
The very Reverend Andrew.
The Reverend Andrew James Gregory, M.A.
Brilliant, what a team. In this episode, we're talking about Sabayon, Google+. We've got our discoveries, suggestions for a new You Dare Us section, Speak Your Brains, the open ballot, and much more. If you love this podcast, which you definitely will, then you'll also love Linux Format Magazine, 136-ish pages of Linux goodness every month. You can subscribe for a great price at tuxradar.com/subscribe. So, let's get into the news then. Sabayon 6 was released.
Yeah, I mean, literally half an hour ago, we all sat down at me to try and think of some news stories, and not much has happened.
It's been a quiet month.
Sabayon 6 has been released, but I don't think any of us have tried it yet.
No, but one thing I noticed is that they're still not going with GNOME 3.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's an interesting line in their release announcement. They said, quote, "Because we do care about our community, we do listen to our users, we consider them part of the game. We decided to leave GNOME 3 out for another last release cycle in order to let things settle down. Providing a broken user experience has never been in our plan." I mean, that's quite a scathing attack on GNOME, isn't it? Describing it as unusable. And
I don't think it's an attack on GNOME. I think it's an attack on... I mean, GNOME are trying to do new things and release early, release often. GNOME are doing the right thing. It's those distros that package it and don't give you any choice that are doing the wrong thing. And I think it seems like an attack on... You know, maybe Fedora and Ubuntu.
But rushing too quickly into the GNOME 3 experience.
The thing is, though, to my mind, I think that's a really good point, actually. I'd never thought of it like that before. But Fedora's purpose has never really been to provide something. It's not a dependable distribution. Whereas Ubuntu, you know, you expect it to be reliable and solid.
Yeah, that's true.
Whereas Fedora's fulfilling its purpose.
Yeah, if Fedora didn't do it, then there would be absolutely no point in GNOME 3.
Yeah.
We can't blame Fedora for being Fedora.
Yeah, it's just doing what it should do, what it wants to do. Whereas Ubuntu, I think, you know, shipping Unity and, yeah, well, anyway.
We've talked about it a lot.
We've had lots of letters on the subject.
Yeah, we have, actually. So it is incredibly important. But I think that's quite an objective decision. You know, GNOME Shell, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, is just too unstable to be a production desktop at the moment. Although John's still using it, aren't you?
Yeah, I've been using it now for about 2 months, 3 months. I really like it. I was just thinking it this morning, actually, that it genuinely feels... It doesn't feel messy, you know, you never feel like, oh, do I do this like this, or does this bit work like this and this other bit work slightly differently. They really have nailed it on making it feel comprehensive, and it feels really solid. I really like it.
So stability's fine?
Yeah, I know. Right. Yeah, I don't have any problems.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that there's just a few things they still need to iron out, like the fact that you've got to hold down the Alt key to shut down with not a single visual cue or anywhere.
Agreed.
That's just mental.
That's small usability stuff, but at least it's consistent in stuff like that. So
it's consistent that you have to press random keys to shut down your computer.
I'm going to back down from what I'm saying now. And just...
What they need, actually, is to get a load of GNOME developers to sit behind people using GNOME Shell.
Yeah.
And then actually making the changes as people encounter those kind of problems.
Yeah.
Maybe that's something they can do at the desktop summit.
Get people to do common tasks. In the Linux format disk pages, when we have a big distro, we have a little section for newbies every month, and it has a list of things to do, how to configure the machine, how to shut down.
Yeah.
You know, and you should be able a lot of time be able to find those things yourself anyway. If it involves just pressing a key that you'd have no idea, that's a massive usability blooper. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they get on with when GNOME 3.1. Are they going to be GNOME 3.2?
Probably 3.2, I think.
Right.
What is it, like November, maybe?
Okay.
September, November.
I've got the feature list for Sabayon here, which is the core release. It says, so there's a CD and USB bootable image, 2.6.39 of the kernel. EXT4 is the default, but ButterFS is an option. Installable in less than 5 minutes. That'll be worth trying.
Whoa.
I might try it when we get back to the office. And then completely customizable, it says. Entropy and portage ready. I guess it's based on Gen 2, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's like a friendlier Gen 2, a pre-packaged Gen 2.
And that's about it. So it looks like quite a good update.
Doesn't Sabayon, isn't that like Turkish for dessert or something like that?
It's an Italian dessert. It's, melted... Is it egg white and sugar syrup or whipped up in something light and frothy?
Hmm. Nice, and with ButterFS as well. I'm starting to get really hungry here. Next up is not quite directly Linux related, but nonetheless it's a very, very big announcement, and that's Google Plus, Google taking on Facebook in the social networking game. Has anybody got any invites yet?
I got an almost invite off Bob Moss this morning.
Same here, but it didn't actually work.
No. Oh, right. Was he been emailing you?
Yeah, he said he suspected that if he could post something and link to it, we might automatically get invites. But I think that just Google are not giving out any at the moment.
No.
I have actually got a Google Plus account.
You look so smug saying
that. I didn't expect it to go down like this. But I got it last night, and it was weird. Because I went to the Google Plus homepage, and it said join now. So I clicked on join now.
Oh, and it worked?
Yeah.
I'm sure I've clicked on that, and it says go away.
Yeah. So I was logged into my Google account. I don't know. I have no idea, but that's what happened.
Graham's going to work for Google very soon.
But it's with the exception of Bob Moss and 100 people I really don't want to chat to, it's pretty useless until people start using it. I mean, I think it's quite neat. I mean, we got excited by Wave, and Wave turned out to be a load of rubbish.
It was too complicated, wasn't it, Wave? It was hard to figure out.
And I'm not, I don't think any of us use Facebook.
No.
Oh, Effie does, Effie does.
He's down with the kids.
But I do like the idea. I do send lots of photos and updates via email to my family. And so what I'm hoping is that Google Plus becomes that kind of stream of family chatter and photos in the same way, actually, that Effie seems to use Facebook without me having to create a real Facebook account other than my super anonymous one that I use for stalking people with.
Cool. Always useful. It strikes me that although I don't use Facebook either, or Twitter or anything actually, but I noticed that Google Plus seems to separate the idea of groups a lot better. So I've seen people's Facebook accounts where it's just one big list of friends, from like spouses to bosses and stuff, all in the same list, and they're very different.
Yeah, they're called circles.
Exactly.
So the circles page, you get a load of contacts that they think are the most useful to you, and then a load of suggested circles. So I actually created a Team LXF circle dragged all of your email addresses in, thinking that maybe that would help get an invite. I don't know. But I've also done one for family, so that it's a really nice interface.
I think being able to keep those things separate more. I mean, apparently groups in Facebook as well, but like I say, you just see a big friend list, and it's a real mixture of people you'd associate with at completely different times. I mean, Facebook is the juggernaut, and like you say, Google has this problem of getting enough people on board. I think it had that problem with Buzz was technically pretty good, but
what I've heard with Google Plus though is that, so, I mean, getting people onto the social networking side is going to be difficult, but they do have a massive number of people use the search engine every day and 100 million odd use their email every day. I've heard that what they're doing is the black bar across the top of all Google's properties, they're actually going to put your Google Plus notifications there. So once you've got an account, every time you search on Google or use any Google property, you'll see new notifications.
Yeah.
So it'll be like a constant pull back to the service. So you'll always be going back to use it, always reminded that you've got it.
That black bar is becoming a bit like a taskbar, isn't it?
Yeah,
system tray.
And it's all tied to the new Plus One feature, which also gets dropped into your Google Plus account, where you see the sites that you've started to rate. And they're rebranding Picasa and one of their other sites. Yeah, for actual Google Plus primarily, right. Because all the photos you post on Google Plus go to Picasa.
Ah, okay.
And so they're creating like a what seems to be a single stream of social networking via the Google Plus portal.
So it's taking all of Google's other services.
Yeah, I think so. Although we were talking about this earlier, and what I think I must be old-fashioned, but I want it to be integrated with my email. I don't want it to be the other way around. When I check my email, I want to see if there's been an update to my family circle from my email. I don't sit there looking at Facebook or probably not the Google Plus page, but I might have to relearn that.
There might be some way to do that.
In Facebook, you have that facility. You can ask Google to send you an email.
Yeah, but I actually want
through email.
I want to see the timeline of all my friends' updates, for example, in my inbox.
I can't really see how that would fit into your inbox.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't. It'd be more like Buzz, because Buzz isn't
right.
A natural email fit.
Yeah.
It would be like a Google Plus. Drag a folder from Google. Drag a filter from Google Plus into my inbox or into my Gmail account, so I can just see all the updates and conversations and images from my mum's holiday.
I think the one thing that we should say is that it'd be really great if Google Plus managed to get some traction, I think, and kind of broke Facebook's dominance in the social networking space. But at the same time, I'm really disappointed that it's not a federated service. It's not an open system. So for anyone who goes and joins Google Plus, you're still putting all of your work, all of your material, anything you publish, is into another walled garden that's not just available everywhere. And there's a really great post on Boing Boing a while ago where it kind of... It was linking to another post, actually, I can't remember where. But the post basically said that it's 1998, and what's better, having your own domain or a GeoCities webpage? It's 2000, and what's better, having your own domain or an AOL profile? It's 2004, what's better, your own domain or a MySpace profile? It's 2008, what's better, your own domain or a Facebook profile or whatever, you know? And it's kind of the same thing with Google, like, It could have been done as an open service, I think, is the sad thing.
Yeah. That's not the way Google works. Do you think Google's worse or better than Facebook?
Better in that I really like the fact that they have that data liberation team who are actively working on making it as easy as possible for you to get your data out of their services in open formats.
Yeah, and the dashboard as well.
Google dashboard
is brilliant. I went onto that the other day and I just saw remnants of bits of data lying around in stuff I don't use anymore, like Picasa and bits of Buzz and stuff. And it's a very clear indication of what information Google stores about you.
Yeah,
but I just wish they think Google could just do it better from the beginning. And not restrict your, you know, they wouldn't have to have a data liberation team and they wouldn't have to have a dashboard if they just built these services as open mechanisms in the first place.
If you actually had the Google equivalent of a home directory that has everything in, you can actually see it, you know, and you can just take it out if you want to. And so everything becomes much more kind of peer-to-peer.
Yeah,
They're providing the interconnectivity, but the data is actually ours.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. It would just, if you could host it on your own servers or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, for people in the States, you know, that's actually quite an important thing in terms of their legal rights, like whether or not the government can subpoena, you know, what the government have to do to access
your
data.
If
it's in your property. I think that's the same in other countries, less so here in the UK.
Yeah, probably not in the UK, if you're, you know.
But, you know, making that stuff available for us is...
I was going to say something about Rupert Murdoch, but I decided against it.
In case he ever buys our magazine. And then Red Hat's profits are apparently up 27% year on year, John just told me before we did this podcast.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
That's
epic.
Good for them.
And Andrea was telling me that they think that if they carry on at the same growth rate, they'll become the first $1 billion Linux open source company by the third quarter of this year. But otherwise, they're pretty certain they'll have done it by Christmas.
Yeah, because we talked about this before, didn't we? Probably 4 months ago or three months ago.
Yeah, about when I started, I think, yeah.
And so it's great that even over the last 3 months, things are still on schedule, even in accelerating.
Yeah.
That was really good.
I respect Red Hat. They're quietly plugging away. They're not making big noises about the desktop. And I remember, in fact, they got massively harangued and slated by the Linux community when they stopped the desktop product, Red Hat Linux, being a box set product and moved to Fedora Core. And people say, oh, Red Hat don't know what they're doing. They're abandoning the Linux market. They'll go down now. But of course, it turned out that targeting desktop Linux wasn't the way to go.
Yeah.
for that time, and now they're making a vast amount of money on server products and enterprise products.
It's really cool.
Yeah, great for Linux.
Their share price has more than quadrupled in the last 3 years.
Really?
Wow.
I'm sure we'll be able to put a link to the some sort of graph in the podcast notes, but it's...
If you send me the link, I'll put it in.
It's, it's comparable with, you know, Apple in terms of just the inexorable rise.
It's really cool.
So when I get that time machine finished, I'm
are they hiring?
They sound like a really great company to work for. Everyone I know who works for Red Hat really loves it.
Let's look for jobs at Red Hat before we send this podcast out. So they can beat everybody else.
Is there a branch in Mexico? Possibly, actually. They have branches everywhere.
Yeah.
But what's really cool about Red Hat is that they do it for right way. They make their money for right way. So all of their sources are released open. All of their development is done upstream. They, you know, they've driven Gnome Shell as an upstream project that can share and integrate with every distribution. They haven't done a Canonical and developed Unity behind closed doors and put it out. You know, they do things properly.
They've got a good open source ethos.
Yeah,
there,
I really respect it. Yeah,
that just runs through the veins of the company, it seems.
Yeah, they are an open source ethos. That's what they are. Yeah,
that is. That's, you know, that's how they make their money.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's stuff like Systemd and Pulse Audio, which people don't like so much, which did come from Red Hat. But at the same time, now Pulse Audio is settled down, it's...
It's much better.
It's not bad. It works. Now that it's settled down, I haven't had a problem with Pulse Audio for 4 years. I only had a problem for the first 6 months when it first came out, in fact. But
let's not talk about it. But Pulse Audio also kind of worked. It's just so complicated.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
I still get latency playing like SNES emulators. I used to play a SNES emulator on a 233 megahertz box on Windows 95. It ran perfectly. On any modern Linux machine, the sound is slow because of these 14 layers of nonsense.
It took me 45 minutes to get an Arda screenshot.
All right, then.
Brilliant. Thanks, Mike. It's now time for Discovery of the Week, Fortnite, whatever.
It's my favourite section.
Yeah, it's my favourite section too, apart from the Udera section.
Speak your brain.
Which is always, what best excuse can you come up with for not doing the Udera challenge?
I liked it when we asked people what they thought of the podcast and Tux Radar. And someone commented something like, just give up on Udera's when you all start sniggering at
them. We'll get to that. This section is the discovery of the week. Discovered anything? Oh, Mike's looking really keen.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks, Mike.
I've discovered that I can't give blood in the United States of America.
Is that because you had glandular fever?
Nope.
Is it because you've lived in mad cow disease, England?
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. Some of you may know this already,
or
but
because the colour of your blood is different.
The colour, my blue, my royal
it's green.
Blue. But yeah, I didn't know this, but if you've lived in the United Kingdom for 3 months between 1980 and 1996,
which most of us have in this room,
yeah, I think so.
Maybe not Effie.
Maybe not Effie. But then you can't give blood in the United States because we all ate probably some beef in that time.
For 3 months?
3 months.
That seems remarkably arbitrary. What if you were just here for a week and you packed in loads and loads of pie munching?
Yeah, if you come on a pie holiday.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. That's it. I don't care whether Red Hat Recruiting, that's it. Pietours.com.
That is interesting.
And it
doesn't surprise me, because when I was in France, they stopped us being able to give blood as well.
It was the same reason.
Yeah. Right. So in Ireland too.
In Germany, yeah. Although it's 6 months in Germany.
And they made us walk through disinfectant as we got off the aeroplane, which is pretty humiliating.
Really?
Yeah.
They still do that now, don't they? Just for a laugh.
They spray you down with anti-English spray.
And my second discovery is a website, www.random.org, which is a random number generator, as you might expect. But it generates random numbers from atmospheric noise, which I think is pretty cool.
Is that a better class of random number than, what, air conditioning noise?
Well, I don't really know how it works, but apparently some lotteries use random.org to generate their numbers. So all we have to do is find the monitoring station for this site that monitors the atmospheric noise, mess around with the atmosphere, program the lottery, win, and the rest kind of writes itself. That's correct. But let's not put that bit into the podcast.
No,
we broadcast.
Right. Because other people might beat us to it.
Yes, exactly. So if you heard that, listeners, just immediately erase your brain with a mind rubber. And those are my discoveries.
Oh, brilliant. That's pretty good.
Thanks.
Anyone?
Yeah, I've got a couple of discoveries.
Brilliant.
I've got, on my new laptop, I've got Ubuntu and Mint. And I've discovered a win for both of those. A win for each. So it's also a bit of a fail for each as well, if you want to look at it that way. The win for Ubuntu is that the internet works on it and it doesn't work on Mint.
Really?
Yeah. I've got no idea why. Absolutely no idea. Wireless, that is. I mean, it works. They both work when they're plugged in.
Is Ubuntu more recent than Mint?
It is, yeah.
Maybe update to Mint 11.
Maybe to Katia, yeah. So there we go. That's great. And the win for Mint is possibly a bit more significant. It's we've all seen when you're logged into Synaptic and then you try and do an update or trying to get something with apt-get and you get the some sort of cryptic message about could not find lock on var temp something or other. And what it actually means is you're still logged in to Synaptic.
Mm, yeah. It's like depackaged locks.
Yeah, and this really quite silly error message has been the same for forever. But in Mint, the update manager says could not get sources or whatever. You are probably still logged into Synaptic.
Or you're probably
still logged in as root somewhere else. I forget what the wording of the message is, but it's actually a message in English.
A helpful error
that is helpful and useful. So, you know, hats off to the Mint people for doing things the right way.
Cool. Could you check if whether or not Mint still has four different names for the trash can? deleted items, waste basket, trash, rubbish bin.
Yeah.
In the last time I saw it.
Garbage repository.
Disposal unit.
I wonder if France. This is something that... La Poubelle. That's it. I've got a couple of others, but they're irrelevant.
Can you do them next podcast?
Next podcast. Next podcast, I probably won't be angry enough about having to move desks for someone who is job sharing.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
Why do you need two desks?
Mine. I've had difficulty thinking of one. But over the last few weeks, we've been putting a lot more stuff on tuxradar.com. By doing some of those things that are on tuxradar.com are from Linux format. And because we don't have a clever XML way of storing our content so that we can easily put it up online, it usually involves copy and pasting stuff from the original documents and then marking them up. And I've been marking it up in Kate. And Kate is the KDE text editor. And it's got this fantastic snippets plugin, which is very much like gedit snippets, but more powerful. You use JavaScript to basically construct commands for searching and replacing or doing absolutely anything you want to. So you can, if you can, it's really simple to add paragraphs and markup headings and all that kind of stuff, but you can do clever stuff like select an image file name and make a link to that image and create a caption and create a box out all around the same thing or with just a simple bit of JavaScript and a couple of commands. Of course, you can use sed and grep and all the rest of it from the quen line. And it's a really good solution. The big downside is that there's zero documentation for it. Absolutely nothing.
How did you work it all out then? Just trial and error?
Looking in the source code. I had to look at the source code to the plugin to be able to see what kind of things I could do.
Whoa. How long's Kate been out? It was in KDE 2, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think Snippets is a KDE 4.4 feature.
Oh, okay.
And also, it's pretty unstable. So it does crash. So every time I do one of those things, I have to save the file and then go back and do it again.
I still don't understand the mentality of adding a feature and then not documenting.
No, neither do I.
In my case,
I think it's terrible.
Whenever I do something, I document it so that someone else can look at it and improve it or understand it. To me, the documentation is as important as the code. They're both part of the same project, you know.
I understand
a coder might have a really awesome caffeine-fueled 5 hours of knocking out a load of code, but then that's just a bunch of gobbledygook on its own. If you tell people how to use it, it matters more.
I mean, even the most simplest task wasn't... I had to go to the source code and check, and that was when you select piece of text and Kate, and then you select a snippet, how do you program the snippet to put, say for example, a heading tag around either side of the selected text? You need a kind of meta keyword for the selected text in the script that you're using, and that is not documented anywhere, and it's the most simplest thing. So yeah, terrible documentation, but it could be a cool feature if just somebody spent an afternoon writing about it.
Yeah, well, maybe we should do a tutorial on it.
Yeah, maybe we should. Yeah,
that show how cool we are at Linux Format, that we read software in order to give you good tutorials. We just delve into C++.
Didn't you read that to have to go through source code for a tutorial you did recently, John?
A little bit for the name shell one, but not much. I kind of gave up on most of the stuff that required me reading the source code and did other stuff because it wasn't what my life's not worth that much.
See, that was intended as a way of bigging you up. But, let's try again. Didn't you have to go through the source code for a tutorial recently, John?
Yes, I did.
But you're so lead.
It's the GNOME 3 source code for the things like lolbutt and question mark.
Definitely.
That'll get him.
Yeah.
It was actually the API. It wasn't the source code. So I actually checked the API, which lists all of the things you can do in it.
Well, at least there's an API. In GNOME Shell's theming interface and stuff, there's nothing there. It's bad.
It's magic. Maybe they want to set up a consulting business one day, telling people how to do it.
John, Heffy?
I've got two. My first one is I found out that I was talking to Mike about this yesterday. I wanted to search through my bash history for a couple of commands I'd executed, and Mike pointed me to the .bash_history file and just grepped through it. Yep. And that works. That's excellent. But I also found out after that if you press Control R on a bash shell, then start typing, it will do like an autocomplete, like on Google search, where it autocompletes. It'll autocomplete with commands on your bash history file, and it will refine it as you type it.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, I use that. Mm. Also, there's the history command.
Oh, what?
If you type history, it outputs the whole history file. Okay. So if you type history pipe grep something,
right, okay,
you can find
so you don't have to grep bash history. Yeah, cool. Yeah, but the control R thing was just, you know, typing out.
Yeah, there's a few of those, because that's like backwards search. There's lots of different ways of doing it. Yeah, yeah. You can, in fact, skip to the argument of a command as well.
Can you?
One of those, yeah, yeah. So you can actually pull up the same command and then just change it.
Maybe we should do a tutorial on bash sometime.
Yeah. Yeah,
I find all these features are great, but I do find them quite scary, because I think I'm going to press some key combination and end up finding an old time where I've done rm star and just delete all my files in my current directory by accident.
Yeah.
You know, it was really cool though, because I've been working with MPD a lot the last few days writing a tutorial on that, and just the amount of times I've had to do the create database command or start and stop the service and can never quite remember the right combinations and stuff, and just the history thing's really great. So and my other find discovery of the week is something called FabFi, which is apparently an open source city scale wireless mesh networking system, which is built basically from rubbish and commonly available material. So apparently the materials to build a node on this network are $60 and they're all locally available. And the first place they did it was in Jalalabad in Afghanistan. And they built this to get broadband to hospital and a school and various other things. It's, you know, it's really, really cool. And I think, you know, they get a throughput of like 11.5 megabits per second with the longest link spanning 6 kilometers.
Wow.
How cool is that?
How did they do that? Is it like big aluminium bin lids?
It's a big aerial. And I think they use something like, I wonder what that is.
The war's about to start, listeners, but we'll carry on. Keep calm and carry on.
The machines, they've woken up.
We shouldn't have badmouthed official Windows magazine. I shouldn't have said that, should I? Yeah, so anyway, FabFi, really cool.
That reminds me of those mods that people used to do where they put a USB Wi-Fi dongle in the middle of a wok. Do you remember that?
No.
People used to claim that they could get many kilometers worth of Wi-Fi signal by putting a USB dongle in the middle of a wok and then pointing it at another USB dongle in the middle of a wok 6 kilometers away, and it apparently worked.
So there were all these geeks going to stop buying woks all of a sudden.
I always meant to try it.
Yeah, there was something you could do with the Pringles can as well, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Except for Wi-Fi area, one of those.
Well, anyway, this is, frankly, amazing. It's a mesh network as well, and anyone can get on it by building their own node and pointing it in the right direction. So, yeah.
That's really cool.
That's cool.
Well, mine, it's not really a discovery. It's more like a, revelation. It's about the latest release of the Skype for Android phones, and I'm gonna tell you why I'm so happy about this. Because back in the 70s, when I was a child, I was completely mesmerized by the concept of video calls and telecommunication. I didn't really do anything about it. I just basically saw it on science fiction films and manga, Japanese TV programs and stuff like that. And I just thought that would have been an absolute fantastic item to have in the future. And I remember in secondary school, we had to do a project about if you were created, inventing something, a device, what would it be? And I sort of came up with the idea of having some sort of watch with video call feature installed in it. And the reason why I'm so happy about it is because I've been using the Skype on my laptop, on my desktop for a really long time, and I've been video calling my family back in Mexico. But the idea of having video call features on your pocket, in your mobile device, it's that romantic, nostalgic concept of 35 years ago.
If you'd patented the idea back then, you'd be a millionaire now.
It would have been... It's just like someone promised you a candy and finally they gave it to you.
55 years later.
Hello.
Hello.
Is that my great granddaughter?
Oh my god. So I think that's what it is. And unfortunately the release of Skype is not available for every single model of Android phones. It's very selected sort of list of devices, but luckily included my mobile phone, and I already used it, and I think it's just the most fantastic thing, that the fact that you got the facility to video call someone using your mobile phone, not plugging your desktop and not plugging your laptop and plugging the webcam in order to do it, whether it works, whether you got the driver for that sort of rubbish. It works on your mobile phone. That is my discovery.
So what's next then? What do you want to happen after this? Your dream has come true for video calling on the move and on a box device. What next? Floating cars?
Definitely jetpacks.
Jetpacks.
Proper jetpacks and shops. you go to a shop, a jetpack shop, and you buy your jetpack shop, and then you have your video call device in front of you attached to the jetpack.
So he just wants to live in the Jetsons.
Well, that's me. That was part of my childhood. But I think it's just, I don't know, I find it quite romantic, quite nostalgic idea finally come through. So thank you, Skype. You're brilliant.
Awesome.
I wish it would be the investment from Microsoft.
But you see, that's my worry. I hope they don't mess things up with the Skype. Like they sort of take all those cool features and mess them up.
Make them only for Windows Phone 7.
Yeah, exactly.
That'd be silly if they did do that.
I think that would be interesting.
Another thing was that I converted my father-in-law to use Linux and installed Ubuntu, the latest version of Ubuntu, on his laptop, and just it works. Everything works fantastically. But that's not the discovery. The discovery was that I had to reinstall XP in one of my laptops because Linux didn't have the driver for a few bits of hardware. And it took me 2.5 days, more or less, in total, to complete the installation.
Of Windows?
Of Windows. Now, it took me 35 minutes to install Ubuntu on my father-in-law's laptop, and it works like a charm. Now, what's going on with the planet?
It's amazing, isn't it?
What's wrong with life?
Yeah, I don't know if Windows 7's any better, but Windows XP used to be hilarious that it would restart like 18 times. You'd install a driver, restart.
You set the date. Restart.
It was terrible. It might be better in Windows 7, I don't know.
But that is just another reason why people should still evangelize about the use of Linux and open source software. There you go.
We just need a magazine, really.
Yeah.
Help spread the word.
Yeah. We could call it Ubuntu Fuckfest.
If you're listening, Mark.
Cool, thanks, guys. That was great.
And so we come to the halfway point of this podcast still to come, You Dare Us, or whatever it may become, Speak Your Brains and the Open Ballot.
Great, so it's time for You Dare Us. And
great!
Last time, we decided that we might try and come up with alternatives to replace You Dare Us with. But before we do, maybe if we do have some good ideas for replacing You Dare Us with, we should maybe over the next 2 weeks have one final send-off for You Dare Us, because Graham had a great idea.
Well,
no, no.
I haven't actually had a chance to think of anything to replace You Dare Us. I think we should keep You Dare Us, because quite a few people have said...
You did say, with You Dare Us, you suggested that maybe we should all draw a penguin.
Yeah, I did.
Which I quite liked.
Well, what I was going to say is, as my idea is, because the problem is that we just... We're too ambitious. So if we do a You Dare Us, we've just got to make sure that we do it. And there should be some jeopardy that if we... I don't know what it might be, but if we don't actually do it, then we have to... I don't know, put something else on tuxradar.com as punishment.
Extra tutorial, yeah, from, yeah, the magazine.
Something like that. So I just think we should just do small things that are actually all right.
I'm going to be ill a lot in the next few months.
Well, if we're going to do it at all, then yeah, make sure we actually do it. So the idea was that in The Guardian last week, there was a small guide to drawing a penguin.
Okay.
You saw it because you sent me the funny link as a response. Yeah. So, yeah, next one, we draw a penguin.
Oh, well, blindfolded.
You can do it any way you want. It doesn't matter what it is or what the results
went
are.
Really badly last time.
I'm going to draw a Lowry-style penguin.
Well, there you go, you see.
I think this could work.
So I think my idea really is not to replace You Dare Us, because people seem to like it, but to actually make sure we pick things that we can do.
Yeah. We have been sincere in the past when we've chosen You Dare Us, but then just the pressure of making a magazine and all the other things.
Yeah, we just don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, it kicks in. So we have thought, you know, oh, we'll help an open source project. That'd be great. And then 3 days later, we're all really busy making a magazine and we're just not having the time to do it. So I think that's a good point. Let's set ourselves relatively trivial tasks.
But did we have any ideas or suggestions for replacements? Just like a back catalogue when this fails. And we need to replace it again.
I thought 5 minutes of meditation. Seriously, just silence, John Cage style.
In the grand tradition of You Dare Us, I've failed to come up with an idea for a replacement for You Dare Us.
Then that's a win, isn't it? You failed at failing. Something. Okay, we're going to draw penguins.
Yeah.
And then what? Scan them in and...
Scan them in and put them in the podcast notes.
Right, and then what?
Maybe we could draw them... Yeah, you don't have to, but I might try drawing it with my paint or some source painting software.
And actually...
Just use paint.
We talked about possibly adding polls to Tux Radar, so perhaps we could try this out as a poll then. We could put the penguins up and readers can vote on the best.
Is there any rules about... The penguin drawing.
I don't think it has to be any. It could be a single line if you want.
A very minimalist, like Japanese style penguin. But Effie's the only one here who's any good at art, so.
I can't draw.
Oh, okay.
Well, this will be fun.
Okay, cool.
Excellent. Well, look forward to that in a fortnight's time. Five drawings of penguins.
My penguin is going to be awesome.
So You Dare Us stays then for the time being?
Yeah, for the foreseeable future.
As long as we can think of simple things to do.
If any of you want to either draw a penguin or send us suggestions, simple suggestions for You Dare Us, then do go ahead and get in touch.
Yeah.
You see, next episode, draw a BSD demon.
Yeah. Draw a gnome foot.
Okay, thanks for sorting that out, John, and saving us a bit of embarrassment. It's time for my favourite section.
I thought that was Discovery of the Week.
Well, it's changed. You know, the podcast is moving all the time. And that's Speak Your Brains. This is where anyone can email me, mike.saunders@futurenet.com, with Speak Your Brains in the subject line. And if it's remotely interesting, useful, short, clever, funny, I'll read it out. If it's 20,000 words asking about how to set up Wi-Fi, I won't.
I love the way you've got such a problem with that.
But I've had, this is a really, really good, this is like a perfect model Speak Your Brains question here from William Judd. He says, I'd love to hear your opinions on Bitcoin, the open source digital currency. Anyone can run the Bitcoin software, which generates coins using a very computationally expensive hash function. They've been hitting the headlines a fair amount recently, and it has been called the most dangerous open source project ever created. Now, John was reading up on this a while back, a few weeks ago.
I just did a what on earth on it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Right, so you know quite a bit about it as well.
Yeah. Well,
is it any good? Is it sensible? Logical?
It's a very interesting idea that unfortunately seems to be getting a lot of negative attention. And it is, I think there is evidence that it's used by criminals,
but
really.
So is cash.
Well, so is cash. Mm. Yeah.
And credit cards and stuff are used by governments.
It's a good idea. And I can't remember whether it's the FSF or the EFF, but Bitcoin's the peer-to-peer, so there's no mint. There's no authority behind it.
Yeah.
The thing that guarantees that you can't create a million of them is the computationally intensive hash algorithm that
But what
that
if you've got a botnet?
Then.
What if you're the Lulzsec people?
If you've got a botnet, that is a risk. I don't think that the biggest problem with Bitcoin isn't that somebody might come around and create a botnet for mining Bitcoins.
I thought there was only so many Bitcoins that could ever be generated.
Yeah, there's a finite number, but that each Bitcoin becomes more computationally difficult to create. Mm. The processing difficulty for creating a Bitcoin is proportional to the amount of processing power in the Bitcoin network. So it should always be equally difficult in a time way, because there's lots of people using GPU farms to create Bitcoins. The fact is that every transaction has to be validated against every previous transaction and every hash in every previous transaction. So those farms are actually validating the transactions and in doing so, generating themselves a tiny fraction of a Bitcoin. So more help you do for the Bitcoin network, effectively, you get paid for in being part of the system that creates Bitcoins, if that makes sense.
But then when it reaches the limit of Bitcoins generated, what incentive does anyone ever have to...
Well,
that's a very good question, yeah.
I read this as well. I really don't know much about economics, but I was reading a Slashdot discussion on this and somebody said, look, I do know a lot about economics, and if you've just got a finite amount of Bitcoins, then a currency needs to have some sort of form of inflation in it to succeed in a system and a capitalist system. Bitcoins can't work because it would just hit a limit.
But no, because at least the value of the Bitcoins is like it's not pegged to any physical thing, so the value of a Bitcoin can change.
Yeah.
So in that way,
and it has changed, and over the last month, it has really changed.
So since people got hacked.
Got hacked.
That's what the Wizard of Oz is about.
Whoa.
Glad you did economics.
Back in ye olden times, I think it was in the 30s, somebody called, an American politician called, I think it was William Jennings Bryant or something, made a speech in favour of moving the US dollar away from the gold standard towards fiat money, which can be more easily, you can print more of it more easily and link it with inflation and stuff.
Right.
So he wanted to move the dollar away from the gold standard, to print more money and ease the effects of the depression and the big dust bowl things. And he made some speech about that you will not crucify mankind on a cross of gold. The Wizard of Oz is an allegory in which Dorothy follows the yellow brick road towards the Emerald City. And finds out that the emeralds, that's the gold. The gold is green, is dollars.
Right.
And the path she follows is gold. And eventually finds out that it's all the sham when she gets there. And it's only worth anything if you believe in the wizard.
Wow. That's amazing. That's amazing.
This is now the best podcast ever.
I already got a podcast title now. That is amazing. I mean, I think it might be all right for certain things, but if I had my savings, of which I haven't got any, but if I did have any savings and they were in Bitcoins. I'd be terrified. You know, yeah, that's it. Because their real world value is just prone to people not hacking it.
Well, it's still an experiment at the moment, isn't it? We'll be able to talk about this more in 2 years or 5 years when everything's settled down. But
I think it's a worthwhile experiment. Definitely. Really interesting idea and great...
It might lead to something else. Yeah. It might lead to a different type of currency that addresses some of the problems people say. But I love this kind of stuff. Giving power back to the
people. Yeah, I love the idea of a decentralized currency.
Yeah.
But so, I'm sure, given enough time, the same trends and the same aspects of humankind will take over the currency, and it'll become just as evil and demonic as gold or diamonds or emeralds.
Thanks, William.
Hi, William.
Bye, William. Next, Leonard Brown. He says, Deja Dupe will become the default backup tool in Ubuntu 11.10. I backed up my system using Deja Dupe to see what I will be doing when I upgrade to 12.04. I couldn't be more unimpressed. The exercise created 1,101 files of 30 megabytes each, one of 7.5 megs, one of 283K, and one of 818 megabytes. My next project was to back up my storage partition. All Deja Dupe wants to do is repeat the system backup. He doesn't sound like he's getting on well with it. I've not used it.
No, neither have I.
I've used it a little bit. It's a very simple tool. It's literally the interface is more or less two buttons.
Right.
One is backup and one is restore. And I think it uses duplicity, the command line tool, as the back end. And so it's really cool because it's backup done right. So it can do it off-site to Amazon S3, to a remote FTP drive over SSH, whatever. It can do all of that. I don't think it has support for encryption, which is maybe its major problem.
Right.
But over SSH, it'll be all right.
Well, depending on how secure the endpoint is, because
right,
you may not want to store it on S3 or something without encryption.
I see what you mean.
I don't know. And the options you have for backup, literally, because there's one backup button and one restore button, you have to do the whole backup in one go. And so it's not designed for doing a full system backup.
It's not incremental then?
Yeah, it is incremental, yeah. It is incremental.
Right.
Because your duplicity is incremental. But if you want to do a full system backup or something of all your system files, you're better off using something like CloneZilla or some other such tool.
Yeah.
Tar.
Whereas this is designed very much for backing up your home directory, backing up your pictures, your music, your documents, and it works very well at doing that.
Cool. There you go, Leonard. Now you know.
I use CloneZilla.
It's excellent, isn't it?
It is. In fact, yeah. I use it with a spare hard drive at home.
I used it with my new laptop in case I ever have to take it back. I backed up the drive before I took Windows off it.
Yeah.
So that if I ever have to return it, I can just re-image Windows on it.
Can't you get a Windows refund then? Presumably you didn't boot into Windows, did you? Or did you?
Yeah, I did, but I'm not that... It's what, like 30 quid, don't you?
Yeah.
30 quid would be nice.
To Microsoft. Ugh. And Richard Klinker emailed to say, I've just listened to the latest podcast, superb as ever, and thought I'd share my discovery of the Fortnite. If you've got a desktop, home server, or even a laptop that doesn't get moved much, that's a bit of a distance from your router, use a power line adapter to take advantage of the ready-made network in your home wiring. It's far better, faster and more reliable than a wireless connection. I have a secondary desktop/server that I had networked using a USB wireless adapter. Being a bit annoyed with mediocre speeds and flaky connection, I thought I'd try a power line adapter setup. It's well worth it. You've got that. You're doing that in your new house, aren't you, Effie?
Yeah, I got a Devolo extender. I used the normal wireless router.
Yeah.
For the top floor, the signal is not going to be that strong. So I used the Devolo wireless extender, which works like a charm because it's got the Ethernet plug as well as a wireless facility. So it's brilliant. That's a brilliant thing.
That's nice. I remember reading about these devices or this possibility of using the mains network in your house for network like years ago, probably 10 years ago in PC Plus, and there were supposed to be all sorts of problems with it, and now these devices just seem to be plug and go.
Yeah, they are really good. We occasionally review them.
We have,
when I've
we?
Reviewed them, they've been really, really effective. Some ham radio enthusiasts complain that it introduces an awful lot of interference, which I think creates problems. If you happen to live next to a ham radio enthusiast, it's likely you'll get complaints. But apart from that,
I'm going to move next to Bazza then and see.
I use two to take one from the phone socket where the router is all the way upstairs to where my main PC is, which doesn't work very well with wireless for exactly the same reason.
Can anybody else who's connected to your electricity network hook up to it and steal your data?
If someone has just one compatible Devolve device, they can plug into their electrical, if your neighbors, for instance, your next door neighbors, they can probably...
On the same loop. It's encrypted, though.
If you haven't secured it, they can
newer Devolo devices are all AES enabled by default. So in the past, you didn't have a password, but now you actually have to enter one.
And
sync them up by pressing buttons. You have to go running around the house.
Oh, that drives me mad when computers do that.
It's a shame they're all encrypted. I thought you could go to a substation with a laptop and just like route 200 boxes at the same time.
Well, you know, you could probably crack it.
So those are the, what's the section called? Speak Your Brains.
They were brilliant.
They were really good. Thanks, folks. Short good and precise. So please do email me, mike.sorens@futurenet.com. Have a chat, ask a question, and we'll read it out.
It's time for Open Ballot. In which we asked, in the light of Firefox moving to they've just changed their version numbering system, haven't they? They've gone from 3.x whatever to going from version 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 to 7. And so they've just come out with version 5, is it, recently?
Yeah.
And with the promise of versions 6 and 7 before the end of this year.
But the crucial thing here is that they're dropping support for the previous releases extremely quickly. So
As one comes out for previous releases, drop support immediately.
Yeah. So, you know, Firefox 5 came out 3 months after Firefox 4. Firefox 4 now has no security fixes. So anybody who's standardized on Firefox 4 now has to update to Firefox 5, and which might break their extensions.
And in 6 weeks' time, they'll have to standardize in Firefox 6, and then 7, 6 weeks after that.
Might break their extensions, change the interface.
It's a stupid idea.
It is really stupid.
If they're going to do that, they should do what Chrome does and just make the version number completely irrelevant and expect people to adopt a rolling upgrade process.
Which is what they're doing, basically, because they're, as part of the change, they're introducing silent, invisible upgrades for end users.
Then get rid of version numbers.
Yeah, I agree. Mm. Yeah, just Firefox, you install it.
Yeah, it's Firefox.
Yeah, that leads to a big problem for business users who need a stable platform. But the best solution I've seen to this is have an LTS release of Firefox.
But at the same time, maybe businesses should adapt to the way that browsers are going, which is the fact that they're much more secure when they're continually updated, and that's it.
And also, if businesses, like, I don't know, but I assume a lot of the problem is that businesses use software that's not built on standards based on in web standards. Like, you know, they use web server-side software that's not built on standards. So, you know, you can use whatever version of Firefox and WordPress will work fine. Whereas, you know, if you want to use some internal, I don't know what we use here at Future, whatever, you know, Outlook Express or whatever, if you want to use a website of that, it may not work with every version of Firefox, and it'll work differently because it's not built on standards.
I'm thinking of things like extensions. I read a few comments on Slashdot about this, of people who were furious about the move, who said, I deploy Firefox in my company. It keeps breaking extensions every release. I don't know why. It's the Linux compatibility hatred
situation. Yeah.
They just can't stand keeping things the same. So this guy said, I've deployed Firefox hundreds of computers in my business, and I'm going to stop. Because they keep breaking extensions.
Yeah, that's just wrong.
So that's the problem. The version numbers, if you're just updating the version numbers and security fixes is one thing, but if you're going to force people
break the APIs.
To break things all the time, people will just
they
not
have
use
to,
it.
They should have ensured.
When you say extensions, what?
Web browser extensions.
What, the plugins?
Plugins and stuff, and add-ons. Yeah, there were loads of them.
How? Why are they breaking the API with each release? That should be the first thing they ensure.
That
add-ons don't break so that that guy doesn't have to... Because he hasn't got any other choice now.
Well... Yeah, I'd probably look at Chrome, but Chrome's running very quickly as well. But
then how does Chrome get around it? Because you never hear people complaining about Chrome.
Because they don't change the API.
They're just sensible. Maybe they've, you know, we seem to have this thing in the Linux world that you can't keep things compatible. You've got to break compatibility all the time. That's the sign of progress in distros and package formats and stuff. But maybe Chrome has just said, you know, we'll keep things the same. We'll have stable, compatible API.
That's something we could perhaps chase when we go to OzCon. is because the last a couple of years ago I interviewed Mitchell Baker, who is the CEO of Mozilla. If she's around or if anyone's around, that'd be a really good thing to put to them.
I mean, the other argument is that they're
she hears the podcast, she might run away. Yeah,
she was really nice. I'm sure they've got a good reason for it.
But the other argument is that they're just chasing home users, and that's fair enough for home users. It's not so important to have a single stable release. But this is just going to.
That's just stupid.
I don't think so. Apparently, it's the proportion of enterprise users to home users for Mozilla. It's ridiculous.
But are the advantages big enough to outweigh the fact that you're abandoning enterprise users? What it seems like it's such a small difference.
A Mozilla developer posted, and you know, it wasn't an official word of Mozilla, as someone pointed out in the comments.
Yeah.
Posted saying that, you know, enterprises may be like a few percent of all their install base. And that did prompt me to ask the question of, you know, what is more important for, you know, driving adoption, enterprise use or home use? You know, do home users persuade enterprises or enterprises persuade home users? But I think if that's the case, it's just a few percentage, then, you know, why make a worse product based on 2% of your users?
Well, that's the same argument.
Make a better product for 98% of
users. We get so often with people not supporting Linux. You know, why don't you port your game to Linux? Because it's only 1% of the
user.
Fair
enough.
Yeah, but I don't see. I think 3% or 2% of Firefox users is still a massive number of people. And the fact is that it's not like a technical problem. It's not like a financial one in the same way that it is for Linux games. It's something that they could easily solve just by actually coming up with a better solution for their update.
Yeah, and when we talk about businesses as well, we're talking about big bodies of people like government departments and stuff as well. If they're going to find it difficult to stick with Firefox because it breaks all the time, then that's a really sad impression of free software.
Yeah.
You can't run it in important things like businesses and hospitals and stuff.
It does indeed. Anonymous Patrick says, Firefox was the best known advertisement for free open software we ever had. Who knows how many users Firefox brought into our world in the past. Their new approach, flicking the finger towards the corporate user, isn't just bad for Mozilla, but the entire free open software movement.
Yeah, I think I feel quite strongly about it. I've just realised.
Well, Hugh doesn't feel strongly. He says, as a Debian user who sticks rigidly to the stable repositories, this won't affect me at all. Bananumerang says, it's kind of the opposite but the same, being on Arch, I roll with whatever updates come my way, so it won't affect me at all.
I don't even use Firefox.
Yeah, you feel passionate.
I did, though, for a long time. And on our corporate network, Firefox is here being used here.
Yeah,
it just becomes untenable.
I don't know. Anonymous Penguin 2 says, I can't think of a quicker way of losing any corporate support for the browser than jumping major versions like this. Fair enough, what you've just said. Gertie reckons, is Firefox moving too quickly? Not on my box, it ain't.
Lol, 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 lol.
Lol, 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 lol. Sultan of Swing, another Lulzworthy. Everyone remembers learning 1, 2, and 3, but what about those big other big numbers? Well, thankfully, I believe I can handle numbers 4 to 10 without too much hassle. I can always use my fingers and thumbs if necessary, so version numbering seems, at the moment, fairly manageable.
Awesome. Yeah, but when we have this conversation in 5 years, what about then? 55, 50.
What about those Inuit tribes that don't have numbers above 10?
Yeah.
Freedom of choice. What?
They just guess. They don't need numbers above.
They don't need numbers above 10
because they don't have anything to express.
They have many.
They don't have 10,000 sheep.
What about they have? I don't know. A big family. Family members.
No.
How many are in your family? I don't know. Cause it's more
maybe children are a single entity.
Yeah, what? How big's your family? I've got kids and a wife.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
I've got two entities in my life.
Yes, freedom of choice says many, many sensible things. Probably the most relevant is, tell me in advance which of my extensions will no longer work and what the alternatives are. I can then decide to update, reject the update, or switch to another browser. A couple of interesting ones here from Prolific Puffin and... Oh no, it's just from Prolific Puffin. I think Firefox is simply going through a phase where they are just trying to get the public's perception of Firefox changed. More words, skip to the end. People don't just want stability and performance, they also want the perception of steady, reliable progression. And so it happens that in the case of Firefox, especially, average users matter. So the switch from 3.1, 3.2, 3.5 to 3, 4, 5 is more about perception than reality. But that still doesn't answer the charge that they're abandoning old versions.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what you do with a version number. You could call them, you can name them after animal farmyard noises if you wanted. It's the fact that if you don't support something with security
fixes,
that is
the real issue,
for more than 3 months, and then you change it sufficiently, you start changing its API and changing the way it works, then you leave people with it.
Yeah, it's not really about version numbers, is it? It's about the fact that support is now reduced to 6 months, which is a short term for anybody's piece of software.
Well,
three months.
Six weeks they're looking for, yeah.
So I'd like to know how Chrome deals with it, and I'd like to know how the kernel deals with it as well, because I know they've had similar complaints in the past.
Well, didn't last fortnight we reported that Mark Shuttleworth was thinking of changing Firefox to Chrome as the default browser in Ubuntu, but didn't for stability reasons.
Yeah, really? The next LTS.
Yeah.
He didn't want to introduce too big a change.
Yeah, that was not with regard to Chrome stability, but more with regard to not messing up Ubuntu, I thought.
Yeah.
Well, he may wish to reconsider that you can't have software that's going to be obsolete in 6 weeks in a long-term support version.
Yeah, Debian guys and Canonical guys are going to be patching versions of Firefox to last in these six-month releases while the Firefox developers themselves have abandoned it. It's absolutely bonkers.
Yeah.
Silly. And final point, anti-penultimate point from Andy.splash. Since Mike loves version numbers so much, what would he do in this situation if he were part of Mozilla?
As I say, it's not about version numbers. It's about, I would make a long-term support release. I would release Firefox 6 and say this is going to be supported for 2 years. And then I'd say Firefox 7, 8, 9 can come out as fast as possible and people can use them. But those companies who need to standardize on a product, have a test suite, have documentation, have extensions that work, have a product that lasts. It's completely sensible.
I think you're right.
We do it with Linux distros. It's great. We have long-term supported distros for companies. Yeah. We have super fast-moving distros like Arch for home users to get the latest bleeding-edge stuff.
They should have two tiers of fixes. It shouldn't be that hard. And they shouldn't break extensions API every 6 weeks.
That's the thing as well. I don't understand why they need to break the extensions API full stop, I suppose.
Yeah, because Chrome obviously doesn't do it.
We need to talk to someone at Mozilla.
Yeah, yeah, we do.
Yeah, it doesn't break every extension, but I've seen enough comments on OS News and Slashdot, like people who get sick of having to keep updating them.
If your LTS version is getting security updates, which it has to do, what's the difference between getting security updates and actually updating the whole browser as long as the extensions API and everything else is fixed?
No, you just give security updates so you know exactly how the browser works. The user interface doesn't change. So your documentation internally for your company doesn't change. You can guarantee that your web apps will work.
Yeah.
So, you know, those who want the bleeding edge stuff where the user interface might change or a new HTML tag or CSS entity might be introduced.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
You know, but just have the two different kind of strands.
Yeah, yeah, I think, yeah.
You know, we've said this is why...
So really convincing.
This is why Debian's really, really great, because you install it and all they will give is security updates and maybe little bug fixes. They won't update a package. They won't suddenly change the interface for a package.
Yeah, yeah,
you know exactly what you've got. You can write a manual on it and it's going to be like that for 3 years or however long it's supported. It's a new office suite isn't going to pop up one day with a slightly different user interface and with new features. It's absolutely rock solid.
Okay, well, that was a fiery Firefox debate.
Whoa, hang on a minute. There is an OMT, as we
call it. Oh, wow.
Everybody loves the OMT.
Magnifique.
actually, some people might know this already, but fingers on buzzers. What was the original name of the Google search engine?
Bing.
No?
No, that was the name of my buzzer.
That's the sound I found, isn't it?
Come on, guys.
I know I'm going to kick myself when you tell me.
Come on.
Is it the name of a dog?
No.
Is it the name of an ex-girlfriend?
Well, I would doubt it.
Rex.
have no idea.
No, I don't know.
It was back rub.
No, I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
Yeah, when they first started it, just for a very short period of time, when the Page and Brin started it, it was back rub because it's relating to backlinks, the system that made Google so awesome at the time, judging page rank by how many pages link to it rather than just other factors. So yeah, back rub.
That's brilliant. How did they come up with Google then?
Well, Google is a misspelling of Google, the number which has got 10 million zeros after it. So it's something to do with that.
Cool.
Next question. Where do babies come from?
Paris.
Okay, thanks very much, everyone. That has been episode 13 of the Tux Radar podcast. Don't forget you can subscribe to the magazine at tuxradar.com/subscribe, and we'll see you all again in 2 weeks with our pictures of penguins. Bye.
Bye. Bye.